Did you know that 70% of all books, including those traditionally published, are sold online via e-commerce? If you're an author wondering how you can get some of that market share, this is for you. Hi, I'm your co-host, Carly Waters, and I'm here to tell you how writers can work on their author brand and build an audience and convert those followers into book buyers. Ever wonder why so many authors publish books and later say that they didn't sell as many copies as they wanted? It happens over and over, and we see it all over social media. Authors think it's a them problem, but not always. They just weren't shown the way. And I don't want you guys to launch a book and show up at book events and have two people in the chairs. I've helped clients launch client books to the bestseller list for 15 years and have built a six-module, 11-hour course with all of my knowledge that will give you the craft and book business information that you simply won't find anywhere else. And there's an app plus monthly Q&A sessions with me. 200 of you have already joined my new course. And as writer Siobhan Moore said, I'm halfway through the course and grieving that I didn't have this information sooner. There's really nowhere else to find it. Worth every penny. If you want the info that will change the course of your writing career, go to carlywaters.com/course to learn more and use discount code POD15. That's POD15 at checkout. That's POD15 at checkout over at carlywaters.com/course. I'll see you there.
Hi everyone, this is Cece. I am so excited to share that I am teaching my super popular Hacking Writing on a Line Level class in November. And this time, it's a three-day event. We'll spend the first 2 days learning rules and techniques that will help you elevate your writing. And then the third day will be dedicated for Q&A. This class is filled with examples, and I mean it. All examples, all the time. So you will leave with an invaluable toolkit to hack your own writing on a line level. Check out the link in my bio on Instagram for more information. I hope to see you there.
Hi there, and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray, and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to another Books with Hooks segment. Carly, will you please just remind our listeners of our new format?
All right. If you have been listening this month, you know we've changed up our format slightly to alternating weeks. So this week is a Books with Hooks week, and next week we will go back to our author interview. Here is our first query letter. Dear Carly and Cece, I am such a huge fan of your podcast. I have learned so much from the critiques and author interviews. Thank you so much for your hard work in getting the info out in such an interesting and entertaining fashion. I'm pleased to present my 77,000 word debut humorous contemporary fiction novel, The Universal Manual of Elevator Repair, which should appeal to fans of the humor and unforgettable characters in Bob Mortimer's Satsuma Complex and Kevin Wilson's quirky absurdism in Nothing to See Here. Elliot Smithton is never going to find love, and even if he did, he wouldn't be able to keep it thanks to his family's curse, a bad luck vortex of accidental deaths. Safes plummeting from windows, slow-moving steamrollers running amok, rabid cows attacking, etc., and he refuses to bury another girlfriend. He forgets all of this, though, as he steps into an express elevator with an eclectic group that includes Lou, an alluring and clever beauty. Elliot dreams of sweeping her off her feet until the elevator malfunctions and Lou, a professional pen thief, fumbles into the elevator shaft while chasing a stolen $100,000 pen. Elliot, on instinct, follows, and somehow, despite his family's curse, they don't end up plummeting 16 floors to their deaths. Instead, they become trapped in a maintenance ledge. Elliot knows how it will end. Body bags all around. The curse says so, unless he can find a way to stop it. He's always presumed his family's sordid past caused the curse, and now that the remedy lay in some ultimate sacrificial act, but he's never been a man of action. Now's his chance, though. In order to do so, he'll have to outmaneuver Lou's beefy lover and two-timing partner in crime while preventing the elevator cable from snapping. And, ultimately, he will have to face his fear of living and dying in the name of love. He needs to succeed because he has big plans for Lou, assuming, of course, that the cops don't have big plans for her, too. As for me, I'm a PhD molecular biologist who spent many an hour toiling with the wording of abstracts and scientific papers and am an active member and former president of the DFW Writers Workshop. My short fiction and poetry have appeared in numerous journals. Thank you so much for your time. Warm regards, John Bartel.
Thank you, Carly. Will you please give us a word count for that and then your take on it?
All right, we're clocking in around 379 words. So, This is very interesting to me because I love this curse concept and I love this kind of closed door mystery, like trapped in an elevator business. But it's not clear to me if this is a real curse or not a real curse. Because if it is a real curse, this is essentially more of a speculative novel in some cases, right? If we have to kind of overcome this curse, or if it's a bit more of a, everybody in my family has been dying in this way. I don't know, this kind of like, is it a curse or not a curse? You know, the word curse is used really loosely here. So I think that is really interesting. And I would love it if it was a real curse, because I think that's cool. I really love the title, The Universal Manual of Elevator Repair. It's kind of one of those titles where you would need like colon a novel after it. So it's like very clear that it's not nonfiction, but it is kind of quirky enough. And you can kind of like visualize a cover for this in a way that I do think is very interesting. And I don't know, I could really visualize this like elevator that they were in, and especially when we get to these pages. So I really liked that. Now I want to get to the Lou business here, because number one, how does he know Lou? Because it comes off a little bit creepy, like he just met her and now he wants to risk it all for her. You know, what is the clear connection here? And then at the end it says he needs to succeed because he has big plans for Lou. Lou seems like a great character in terms of, you know, she's a thief. She just seems like she has a lot of agency, and this idea that like he has big plans for Lou. I'm like, what about Lou's plans for Lou? You know what I mean? I'm just wondering, we're kind of pigeonholing her as this kind of like romantic interest in a way that is kind of reducing her agency. And she seems like a really interesting character here in a way that I'm like, should this book even, you know, include some of her thoughts? Because again, she seems super interesting. But I like that, you know, she's a bit mysterious. You know, she has a lot going on in her own life here. And there's a bit of a mystery to solve in terms of, you know, this stolen $100,000 pen and how are they going to get out of this situation? All of that is really great. And then in terms of the author bio paragraph, you say, you know, your work has appeared in numerous journals. I would probably list a couple journals. You know, your query letter isn't super long, so you could maybe name a couple notable ones there. I think that could be useful to you. But yeah, I don't know. I think this, I could really visualize this. This was very like cinematic to me in an interesting way. So I think this is kind of fun if we can kind of get at the heart of what's going on with this curse. Is it real or not? And how we can frame Lou as a character with a bit more agency.
Thanks, Carly. Yeah, I also love this title. It's the kind of book I would pick up just based purely on the title alone. Okay, Cece, your thoughts?
I very much agree with the note about Lou's agency. I kept being like, it feels like all of her things are connected to you. And I wanted like to know like what her own thing was. That made a big difference for me personally. I think here's the thing. First, you're asking us to believe in a curse, which I can get behind really easily because I love books about curses, whether it's real or imagined or whatever. Two, you're asking us to believe that he falls in love with her purely from looking at her 2 seconds in an elevator, and that changes his whole life. That's a big, big thing to accomplish in terms of the execution of the story. Like, it is very hard. Love at first sight, and that derails his whole life. Like, that is huge. Can you do it? Hopefully. I really hope so. But again, it's incredibly hard to pull off. Some things are easier to pull off than others. This is like really, really hard. And then the third thing is, it read like a play to me, because if I understood correctly, it all takes place in the elevator. And so like it's very contained, which is fine. That's not an issue. But you are up against the fact that you won't have a lot of movement. And I don't understand how the ex-boyfriend features into it. Because again, the ex-boyfriend seems to be an obstacle and the police seem to be an obstacle. And I'm like, did Lou also fall in love with you? Like, what about Lou made you fall in love with her? I have a lot of questions about the romance. And this story will only work if I believe that he fell in love with her. And I also kind of fall in love with her, right? Like through him. So that's the really important piece of it too.
Thank you, Cece. Okay, Carly, can you tell us what's in the opening pages?
All right, so we start with our main character. They were kind of up late drinking on a hotel rooftop, flirting. It doesn't really go well in terms of how we thought the ending might be. He gets into an elevator and he is thinking about the people that he's kind of interacting with. He knows somebody on the elevator was missing a pen, which is interesting because of the query letter. And then he's also thinking about his kidneys and potentially there might be like a donor situation kind of hovering in the background, maybe something he's escaping. He meets some more hotel guests, a small family, and that's kind of where we end.
Okay, great. Right. So can you tell us what you thought of them?
Okay, so one thing I think we absolutely must have in this book is a timestamp. And it's so crucial here because we need to know at kind of at what time he's coming down in the elevator, what happens in each situation, because we know there's going to be a bit of a ticking time clock here. So I can't emphasize enough how badly I would love a timestamp with exactly what time in the morning he's kind of coming down the elevator. In terms of his character, so I think that the author knows this, but he is coming off slightly pathetic in the sense that, like, he's got this hangover, you know, he didn't kind of accomplish what he wanted with this girl maybe last night, and he's kind of like a little bit mopey and just like blah. And because I get the sense that, I kind of mentioned this in my overview, but we get the sense that somebody wants him to donate a kidney, and this is something he's kind of been mulling about. So maybe this is him escaping, dealing with reality or something like that, which I think is interesting, but you're barely telling us that. You know, I kind of had to like read between the lines to get there. So I do think that is interesting because we don't really know why he's there. Like if it's an event, and it's not that you have to answer it flat out, but I guess I'm curious about like why you're choosing to tell us what you're choosing and what you're choosing not to tell us, because I think we kind of have to work on that balance a bit of kind of like what details we actually need as readers versus what we don't. So he's pretty unlikable. You know, for an example, it says in HR sensitivity training, they'd been forced to sit through toothpicks propped between eyelids to keep them awake. An extremely attractive babe had lectured them about unconscious bias. She'd said that it only took 7 seconds to judge people. Elliot raised his hand. I can do it in 3 seconds flat at the longest. The silence that swept into the room felt to Elliot like a standing ovation. I'm like, that's a pretty unlikable thing about a character. It's interesting because you're like, oh, this guy thinks he knows it all, da 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 da. But, you know, we have a lot to build on here in terms of liking this character. And there's always an argument, of course, you're probably thinking, Carly, does every character have to be likable? No, they don't have to be likable, but we have to want to spend a lot of time with them. And so that's kind of the important piece here is, you know, do we really want to spend hours and hours with this character? Yeah, so those were some of the notes there. I do have some notes about the logistics of the situation, because earlier on in the opening pages, you say he really wants to get down to the lobby. And then you say he pushes the button for the 22nd floor. And then I was like, okay, you said above that he wanted to get to the lobby. And, you know, so that would be the ground. So what's on the 22nd floor? So I think it's just, you know, did he need to stop off at his room? Because we know through the query letter, and then the reader will eventually know through the jacket copy, that they're going to be, you know, the elevator is going to stop and there's going to be this big dramatic thing, is we're waiting for the big dramatic thing to happen. So the fact that it's like, oh, he's not going down to the lobby, he's actually going to the 22nd floor, you know, that's interesting. So we just kind of need to purposefully keep the readers on their toes versus confusion over, was he actually supposed to go to the lobby and he actually in his hungover state pushed the wrong button. That was interesting to me as a choice. And then the final people that he meets in the hotel is a family, two parents and two kids. And I really didn't believe this setup. You know, it's kind of supposed to be like a mom is drinking alcohol out of a, you know, a bottle in a paper bag. And then the dad is supposed to be a hipster. And the kids are purposefully written to be incredibly annoying with a weird name. And I think the kid swears or something like that. I don't know. I was just really confused by the situation of this family. I really personally, I think for the purposes of this novel, would have really liked for us to kind of get right into the situation with the elevator moment and the delay so we can start our ticking clock faster. I know it's really hard with a short sample, but meeting this family did nothing for me in terms of character development for our main character, unless this is the family he's going to be stuck in the elevator with, and then the elevator kind of trapping is going to happen really fast. So that's kind of where my head's at with this piece. We don't encounter Lou in these pages unless Lou is the woman on the rooftop, and I don't think her name is given. In that case, maybe, again, that's going to come up later in these pages, and we're going to kind of click all that together. But again, still, I don't like the way that he talks about the woman on the rooftop. I don't like the way that he talks about the woman who was doing this kind of HR session. So potentially, I'm not the target audience for this book. That's probably true. Or this character has a lot of growing to do, and you're assuming the reader's going to want to go on that journey with them.
Thanks, Carly. Yeah, I think a lot of times authors focus on the character arc and they go, this is, he starts off being a real
asshole and he's eventually going to become great. But you've got to remember that the reader's got to want to be there for the whole journey. And something I'm seeing a lot of when I'm seeing first acts that I kind of call failure to launch is that we are not starting off with giving the character something that they desperately want that has high stakes tied to it. So I'm prepared to hang around with this so-called unlikable protagonist so long as I know what they desperately want, why it matters. And it would be so easy to give him something he desperately wants, and then the elevator breaking is an obstacle to him getting what he wants. So he needed to desperately meet this woman at this particular time, and he really is into her, and he already thinks he's running late, and he's looking at his watch, and then the elevator stops. And, you know, give him something that the reader can relate to, that he wants it, and we understand why he really wants this thing, how important it is, and then the elevator breaks, and that's an obstacle. So even if you begin with unlikable protagonists, give them something they want, give them something with high stakes, because I really think that helps as well to get on board with them. And I'm seeing so many novels where it's like the character doesn't really want anything. There they were minding their own business when this thing happened to them. And it just doesn't grab the reader by the collar and pull them in the kind of way that it does when the character has something they want and it has high stakes. Okay, Cece, passing it across to you now.
I think the question of does a protagonist have to be likable is a really interesting one. And to me, the answer is it depends on what you mean by likable. If by likable you mean virtuous and kind and polite and moral, the answer is no. The character does not have to be likable. If by likable you mean layered, contradictory, and most of all, vulnerable, then yes, the answer is yes. Because to me, likable, it doesn't mean I stand behind who you are as a moral person. It means I want to spend time with you, to Carly's point. And so it's really important in order to find the interesting, you have to dig for layers and contradictions and most of all, vulnerability. And I'll give, you know, the writer here two examples of places where you could add vulnerability. So you have him observing the children pushing the buttons, and he says, nobody is stopping the kid from pushing the buttons. In his mind, is he thinking of how he could never get away with that as a child because his father would have, I don't know, maybe slapped him, maybe said something to him, or how he really wanted to as a kid, but he knew better because of the household he grew up in, or something else. I don't know. Something that would add vulnerability. That would make me feel for him. That would make me go, this is why he's so annoyed at this kid. It's because a little child inside of him didn't get to push the button.
Even Cece, if he thinks that when he was a child, he would have given anything to be able to go to a hotel, but because of their financial situation, they never got to go on vacation and they never got to go to a hotel. So then again, you're getting this sort of backstory and context. 100% agree with you there.
Yes, so true. Like, this kid is so lucky to be in a hotel and he's squandering his luck by pushing buttons. Does this kid not know how good he has it? Exactly. So, and then, you know, as another example, there's a part where everyone freezes and stares at him. And the dad in the group says, see what happens when you're not aggressive, Sally? Some rich businessman is going to come along and take away all your opportunities. Happens all the time in day trading. He's being characterized by the stranger as a rich businessman. A great opportunity for vulnerability is for him to go, because this is not something nice that's being said to him. But if he went, oh my God, they see me as a rich businessman. Like, I've made it. Not that obvious. But do you know what I'm saying? Like, if you're being accused of being a terrible person, but someone called you rich or someone called you hot or someone called you something else, and all you're focusing on is on that quote unquote compliment, that shows your vulnerability so much because it shows that you spent your whole life battling to reach that status. And I feel for you, even though you're kind of a jerk, let's be honest, I feel for you. So if you want vulnerability, these are examples of where you can insert vulnerability in your story in a way that's baked into the scene. Don't go off and make the mistake lots of writers make, which is like, and now here's my paragraph with vulnerability. No, no, it has to be connected to the actual scene, to the pushing of the buttons, to the dialogue, to whatever else. So yeah, those are my notes.
After spending our summer vacation this year in Europe, it opened my eyes and my kids' eyes to the power of language and finding common ground no matter who we are and where we are. One of the most important things to me as a parent of two is making sure my kids see other places in the world and are exposed to the languages they speak around the globe. They're in French immersion education, and I'm honestly already getting left behind. I took French class in school until grade 9, and I have a big gap in my learning that I'm ready to fill. And that's why I rely on Rosetta Stone, the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app. And it truly immerses you in the languages that you want to learn. I know my kids' language learning skills are going to explode past me, and I'm ready to catch them. And that's why we have Rosetta Stone. It's a trusted expert for 30 years with millions of users in 25 languages offered. We're talking Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Dutch, Arabic, Polish, and many, many more. There is fast language acquisition. Rosetta Stone immerses you in many ways. There are no English translations, so you really learn to speak, listen, and think in that language. There's an intuitive process. You're picking up a language naturally, first with words and then with phrases and then sentences, and it is designed for long-term retention. There is speech recognition technology. It is called True Accent. It is built in. It's a feature that gives you feedback on your pronunciation. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. It's convenient. There is super flexible learning anytime, anywhere. Learn on the go with a mobile app or on your desktop at your schedule. There is amazing value because you have lifetime membership for all 25 languages for any and all trips and languages that you need in life. That is a steal. That is 25 language courses from Rosetta Stone that they offer it for 50% off. So don't put off learning that language. There is no better time than right now to get started. Shit No One Tells You About Writing listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. So go visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
I just do want to say to this author that the very first novel I ever wrote was called No Rest for the Wicked. I do think The Good Place, somebody in The Good Place stole that novel from me because it was about somebody who died and had to go through a reincarnation service provider company to get reincarnated. And the mistake I made with that was my main character was the worst individual in the world and had zero vulnerability. He had the best lines. He was hilariously funny, but absolutely nothing redeeming whatsoever. And big surprise, that novel got turned down by absolutely everybody sort of 18 years ago when I wrote that. So I've been there, I've made that mistake and have certainly learned from that. Okay, right. Thank you so much for that. Cece, let's go to your query.
Dear Cece Lira, thank you so much to you, Bianca and Carly, for the gift of Tis Not Ya. Your generosity of time and expertise is incredible and I eagerly await each new episode. I'm seeking representation for my upmarket book club novel, Saturations, complete at 88,000 words. I thought of you because of your interest in contemporary fiction with unexpected speculative elements. My novel would appeal to readers who enjoyed the raw portrayal of parenthood and use of magical realism in The Upstairs House, and it shares with Joan Is Okay a balance between complex family relationships and high-stakes medical setting. Single mother Ren Spector is struggling to balance parenthood with her demanding career as a nurse in the neonatal ICU. She is a professional compartmentalizer who survives by remaining at arm's length from those around her. Her defense mechanism is stripped away, though, when a concussion gives her a strange side effect, a medical condition called Bell's mirror touch synesthesia that causes her to feel the physical sensations and emotions of everyone who crosses her path. As if her own responsibilities and feelings weren't overwhelming enough, she is now awash in everyone else's experience. Her toddler's anger when she has to eat from the blue plate instead of the pink one, the confusing pain an infant experiences during an IV insertion, and worst, an overwhelming array of fear, guilt, and tension from the NICU patients. While she is suddenly a brilliant diagnostician for her premature patients, Ren flounders even more than usual in her relationships with adults, including her aging parents and an inconvenient new romantic interest who pushes back against her long-held trust issues. Making things more difficult, Ren gets to know two NICU moms whose lives have been affected in very different ways by the community's fentanyl crisis. If Ren doesn't figure out how to survive her new ability with empathy rather than numbness, she will risk being responsible for one woman losing sobriety and her daughter, and the other remaining in a toxic relationship. Keeping her distance could mean losing the career she loves and the human connection she desperately needs, but getting too involved could throw her into a path of dangerous drug distributor and put her life at risk. I have a BFA in creative writing from Chapman University, a master's in philosophy in Irish writing from Trinity College, Dublin, and a PhD in literature studies from the University of Denver. I work in the academic editing field and recently published a nonfiction graduate school guide titled PH Done, Skyhorse 2023. This is my debut novel. I live in Colorado with my husband and daughter, whose difficult NICU start is thankfully far from evident in her vivacious toddlerhood. The first 5 pages are enclosed. I'd love to send you the full manuscript if you're interested. Thank you for all your time and all the best, Lauren Saunders.
Thank you, Cece. Okay, so that came in at 479 words for that query. Cece, will you give us your take on that?
For sure. So, first of all, we must talk about the fact that this inciting incident situation is very cool. You know, she can now feel people's emotions and pain, and like that makes her a brilliant diagnostician, but also gets her in trouble. Genius. Love it. Very high concept. I'm like into it. Again, very, very cool inciting incident. I will be honest and say that because of this very cool inciting incident, I would scroll down and read regardless. But my job is to give you notes on how to make this even better so that lots and lots of agents want to scroll down and read. And I don't think that you're doing the story's justice after the inciting incident. You spend a lot of time describing how her new ability has changed her, like the pink plate and the blue plate and all that thing. And our Substack subscribers, I want you to look at the 3 plot paragraphs. So there's the paragraph with all the metadata, the 88,000 words and all that, the comps, and then you have 3 plot paragraphs. Notice how plot paragraph number 2 and 3 seems like we're talking about 2 completely different types of books. Plot paragraph 2 talks about the fact that she's floundering in her relationship, including the one with her aging parents, and then a new romantic interest, right? And we know she's a single mom and she has all those challenges. She's a doctor. And then plot paragraph number 3, there's these 2 women who are affected by the fentanyl crisis, and she's going to be responsible for one of them having a toxic relationship and the other one losing her daughter, which I imagine is custody. And then there's this drug distributor person who's going to come after her and put her life at risk. So I'm like, what? Wait, which book is it? And by the way, those 2 sound like very cool, but very different books. So for me, I'm not saying you can't have all these plot points. You can, but I need to see a tie between them that makes sense in my brain. So if I knew about these 2 women earlier and they were connected somehow to, I don't know, her parents, like, I don't know how to do it because I would need to know so much more about your story, so I can't fix it, but I can see what needs to be fixed. I worry that it seems disconnected from themselves and honestly from the protagonist. So again, I'd much rather have known about these 2 women before her ability kicked in, only to then learn that like when her ability did become a thing, there's this new layer and the plot points are somehow connected. Again, this is really one of those situations where I could be like, tell me about your book. Hold on. We'll do this together. And then I could get like my pen and like kind of help you as a starting point, by the way, because it would take so long to do it. And I don't know your story, but like, I do think that there's something there about the lack of connectivity between these plot points that feels like a repeated note given the last episode we had on Books with Hooks. So it's something to think about.
Thank you, Cece. Yeah, I remember those tipping dominoes are so important. You want causality as opposed to satellite plot points where these things are all kind of happening around but aren't causing the next thing and aren't connected to each other. So when you're busy looking at your plot points, go, if this domino tips, how does it affect the next thing? As opposed to, I've got dominoes tipping and they're not tipping each other over at the same time. Okay, Carly, what was your take on that?
I love this inciting incident as well. It gets, you know, full claps for being just super interesting. And this feeling of, this is what I think is really exciting about this pitch, is what this feeling of this book could go in so many different directions. You know, you provided us with this inciting incident and we don't know where it's going to go. You know, you could take us on so many different journeys. And so as an agent reading this, I'm like, okay, which version of this story is she going to tell? And ultimately, is it the version that I'm going to connect with? I think what ended up happening as I started reading was I didn't feel like this was maybe the version that I wanted to read, in the sense that I'm not sure, is she trying to cure herself? Is this speculative? Like, where are we going that's going to provide us with like a twist later? It seems like it ends up still staying pretty grounded in reality. And I also was curious about, you know, and I couldn't really tell from the query letter, and I don't know, obviously it'll show up in the pages, but this seems very focused on her work, which is interesting. This is clearly a huge passion of hers. Doesn't really talk too much about her family throughout the second half of the pitch. You know, it starts with like single mother trying to balance parenthood and career. But she doesn't work in a job like as a neonatal ICU nurse. Like she doesn't work in a job where she could potentially make a lot more money from this special skill, or she can like accelerate on a growth plan in this way that's like pitting these moral things against each other in a way that I think could have been interesting if she was given a different job. But if she was given a different job, we wouldn't get this like humanity of her being able to like experience all of these like deep, deep emotions, which is so interesting about this. So I don't know. I guess I was kind of, as I was reading, I was like, is this the version of this book that I would want to read? I don't know if it is. It's not telling me potentially that it is, because like, I almost feel like she needs to teeter on the verge of insanity almost. Like, wouldn't you just start to build up this pressure where you're just like, you just want to scream. Like, you're just feeling all these feelings all the time. So I didn't really get the sense that we were getting to this point of just emotional explosion, or her like having to blow up her whole life because of this. It was much more related to other people's outcomes and not her own outcome. So I think that was what holding me back here. But anyway, this is just an absolutely brilliant premise.
Wonderful, Carly. Thank you. Okay, Cece, we're throwing it back to you. Will you tell us what happens in the opening pages?
So we have our protagonist playing with her daughter ahead of her night shift, feeling overwhelmed, but trying her best to stay positive and present for her child. She thinks back to the birth of her child, the magnitude of her decision to be a single mother. The house doesn't have any food, but she's trying her best to let her daughter help with dinner, to give her daughter agency. She hands her daughter a little play knife and has her cut tomatoes, except she turns around for a second and her daughter almost reaches for like a real knife, but the protagonist intervenes just in time, avoiding disaster. The babysitter arrives and asks the child, you know, and apparently she really loves her babysitter, her child's babysitter. And, you know, the babysitter asks the child, do you have a hug for mommy? And the child refuses. This is like new behavior. And at the hospital, she chats with Adam, who's a nurse who's super competent, and she really likes Adam.
Right. Thank you, Cece. Okay. What was your take on them?
We review so many pages for the podcast, and sometimes my notes, I feel like they're a little bit more theoretical. Sometimes they're very direct. This is a very direct situation. You're not starting in the right place. Start somewhere else. Don't know where. It's not here. Telling you right now, I am 1,000,000% sure of this. I get why you picked this scene, because it's so emotional and you're doing an amazing job of capturing her overwhelm as a mom, right? Like the fact that she wants to stay present for her daughter, and in her head she's going, oh man, I should have said yes to the babysitter's offer to arrive early so I could like be getting ready right now instead of dealing with this. But like dealing with this as my daughter, and I love my daughter. Like great job with the emotionality. Great job with the interiority. Not the right place to start. Why? Because you want your novel's entry point to have power imbalance and a disruption and something that's juicier. And I hate to say it, it's not juicy. Is there a power imbalance? Sure, because technically speaking, it's actually quite interesting how much power a toddler can wield. But it's not juicy. It's not inherently interesting because nothing is happening in this scene that's making me go, and I wonder what's going to happen next about why. Do you know what I'm saying? Like about X, about Y, about A, about B, about C. So you must pick a different starting point. It's too contemplative. What these pages are doing is they're setting up her life. They're setting up everything that happened before the story started, as opposed to starting the story. So I have notes for you, but I strongly feel like you're starting the wrong place. I do think you should keep this scene, just not here. And when you do keep this scene, I have another very strong opinion, which is when the babysitter arrives, we have her thinking about how she loves the babysitter. Like the babysitter is the best, right? Love that. Keep that. But she would also have complicated, messy emotions, jealousy, envy, resentment, amidst the beautiful feelings of gratitude and appreciation. One of the things I look out for in stories are you digging to find the messy emotions? So if the on the surface emotion is positive, the next layer needs to be so-called ugly. And then after that, another beautiful layer. And after that, another ugly layer. And that's just human nature. You know, you look at this person who takes care of your child and you're so grateful she exists. And there's a tiny, tiny part of you that's like, my child loves you too much. Does my child love you more than me? That's ridiculous. Of course it's ridiculous. But does she? And, you know, I resent the fact that you get to spend the whole day with my daughter, but then I also want to go to my work. And that's the messiness that you need to add here in a way that's subtle and interesting and that reveals her character. I don't know what kind of mom she had, and I should know, even like a tiny, tiny, like 4-word sentence, because that's what goes on through a person's head. I heard from my mom all her life that she did not have a outside of the home job because her mom did, and that messed her up. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, that's what people do when they parent children, when they go about their whole life. They try to not make the mistakes their parents made, and then they feel all these messy emotions instead of just the objective, nice, sweet, kind emotion. So I really wanted more, and I have all these notes for you. So I do think you have a lot here to develop and to make really, really cool and interesting.
Okay, Cece, thanks so much for that. Carly?
All right. I didn't make a ton of notes here. I felt like the writing itself was really good. I do agree with Cece that we're probably not starting in the right place, only for the reason of I don't actually find these pages especially like memorable, you know? And I think that one of the issues when we send things to editors will say things like, you know, in order to fall in love with a novel, I have to make sure, you know, when I put it down that I have to really want to come back to it. And so when we don't have opening pages that are like so incredibly memorable, so gripping, you know, you're thinking about it for the rest of your day, or you wake up in the morning and want to get back to it. Like, that's the level of intensity that editors have to feel about these opening pages. You know, I think the thing that Cece flagged was the thing that really stood out to me. It was kind of the oof, gut punch moment, which is, you know, talking about handing over to the babysitter. And so that whole, like, you know, the mom just like, you know, wanting to express, like, do you have a hug for mommy? And it's like, no, I don't want to hug her. And, you know, this push and pull of knowing you're going to work to provide for your family and your daughter not wanting to give you a hug. You're like, oh, that's a gut punch. But in this way, that is like super compelling and interesting. And just, again, like Cece said, speaks to the kind of complexity of our human emotions and how we want a parent and how we have to provide for our family in a capitalist society and being a single mom and all of those really interesting things. So that's the piece that I took from these pages of 5 pages. That's what's going to stick with me, if you're curious.
Thank you so much, Carly. And Cece, for our listeners, spare me a thought. I am busy working on opening pages over the next month that I will then show Cece for my new novel. And I generally sit and chew my nails down as I'm waiting to hear, you are starting in the wrong place. So yeah, I feel your pain. Right. So thank you to you both. And for everybody, please tune in next week for our author interview. We're really looking forward to that. Have a good one.
A reminder that this is an unscripted program and our conversations have been edited and condensed and is not a full picture of our feedback or conversation directly with each author. As always, refer back to our written notes for the fulsome picture. Carly Waters and Cece Lira are agents at PS Literary Agency, but their work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly and Cece on this podcast are solely that of them as podcast co-hosts and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literary Agency. A reminder about all the ways that you can support us as a show: rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, tell your writing friends about us. We'd love to help as many writers as possible. And follow us on our Substack newsletter. Get our stacked newsletter on a weekly basis, bonus videos, articles, essays, advice, and more. You can find it at theshitaboutwriting.substack.com. That's theshitaboutwriting.substack.com.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes. Fantasy writers, I hope you'll be joining me for the All About Fantasy full-day virtual retreat on the 28th of September from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time. Whether you write YA fantasy, romantasy, adult fantasy, epic fantasy, cozy fantasy, dystopian fiction, or any other variation of the genre, you won't want to miss out on this amazing day of learning dedicated especially to you and those writing in your genre. The lineup includes award-winning and best-selling authors, as well as literary agents and editors who specialize in the genre. You'll have an opportunity opportunity to submit your query letter for critique. The Story Engine, who is sponsoring the retreat, is also hosting an awesome giveaway of an All Things Fantasy storytelling package that contains a copy of each of their decks, Story Engine Deck and Deck of Worlds, each with their associated fantasy expansions, the mythology, dystopian, and fairy tale boosters, valued at $237. All delegates will also receive discounts when shopping on the Story Engine website. Come and learn, ask questions, and even more importantly, build community. To find out more and to register, go to my website, biancamaray.com, and look for the All About Fantasy tab. I hope to see you there.
Hi, everyone. This is Cece. I am so excited to share that I am teaching my super popular Hacking Writing on a Line Level class in November. And this time, it's a 3-day event. We'll spend the first 2 days learning rules and techniques that will help you elevate your writing. And then the third day will be dedicated for Q&A. This class is filled with examples, and I mean it, all examples all the time. So you will leave with an invaluable toolkit to hack your own writing on a line level. Check out the link in my bio on Instagram for more information. I hope to see you there.